Welcome to the 186th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. Thanks for listening. So, I'm training for the California International Marathon in Sacramento, so that's going well. We had our first Monday here, fall, as officially came to Florida. We had a 55-degree Monday this week, so it was heaven to go outside and run and not feel the humidity. It's warmed up a little bit each day, but still we're having in the 60s in the morning, so it makes it great. Tomatoes also love it because they're able to bloom now and they're not being choked with humidity. And so we're getting some tomatoes. Peppers are coming along. It's been dry. We finally got some rain today. So the garden is like, we had our one and only persimmon that we picked, have a few figs. Herbs are going along, so finally have cilantro and basil at the same time. So the garden itself is going pretty good. So everybody likes this cooler weather. As most of you know, we have a membership practice, and we have nutrition classes, 3 a week, and we talk about frustrations and what our problems with our members that are plant-based or trying to become plant-based, and what are some of the hurdles that they face. And I mentioned last week that someone wanted to go out to dinner. Her husband always wanted to go out to dinner in the evening. And so they went to a place called the Moose Lodge. They have them everywhere in the country. And she was forced to get a taco, a beef taco. And oftentimes, especially when spouses aren't around, that people blame their spouse for their problems remaining plant-based. And yes, it is a problem when the house is mixed, that the one spouse wants to not be plant-based and the other one does. And it can be a little bit of a hassle to make a separate dinner or to keep meat out of things. In my view, you just make meals simpler. Potato, vegetables, beans, and then they can have a piece of meat. If you make a casserole, you just leave the meat out. They can have some meat on the side. That's the way I would deal with that. But when somebody wants to go out and they pick a place where there are limited choices, then sometimes people just give up after a while. And a lot of choices in Florida are around socialization. People want to get socialized together. People want to go to various clubs for fundraiser, play cards, you know, whatever. And so the Moose was the problem this week. So I decided to actually go to the Moose, and I contacted the director of food services there, and I had a meeting with him on Monday. And much to my surprise, he was very, very accommodating. He listened to what I had to say. I talked to him about plant-based nutrition and how it's been shown to reverse disease. I also talked to him about the importance of people being able to go out and socialize with their friends and have a sense of purpose and you know, get out and have a good time. And so we want all that, but we want people to be healthy when they do go out. And, you know, so we talked about potential alternatives. And the first thing he said was, well, we always have baked potatoes and baked sweet potatoes available the majority of the time. And if somebody would just call and let me know that they're coming, we'll make sure that we do always have a baked potato. You know, if we ran out, then it would take longer to make one. And so their meal could be delayed. So if they call ahead, we'll make sure that we have the potatoes baked and ready to go. There was no problem eliminating cheese off the salads. There was no problems adding beans. There's no problems doing, you know, simple dressings as opposed to creamy dressings. Things weren't dressed early on. They actually had veggie burgers available. He said that the demand for vegetarian vegan dinners was very minimal, but if I had members that were members of the Moose and there weren't going to be, you know, an increase in demand, then he would make menu items accordingly and even potentially add plant-based or vegan items to the menu. And he even offered that maybe I could come down and speak to the members if they were interested in hearing about the lifestyle reversing benefits of a whole food plant-based diet. And I said, I'd love to do that. I'd love to be able to speak with them. And so we're going to keep a dialogue moving. And then over the next few weeks, if members are interested in hearing about healthy alternatives, then, you know, I'd like to speak with them. I'm all for people going out and having a good time and socializing together. But you don't have to kill yourself in the process eating, you know, greasy, cheesy meat, protein, in the process. So, I think that was a really good, meeting. I was there for about 40 minutes. And again, he was very, very pleasant. Took my card. I asked him to listen to the podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast, I really, give you a shout out. Really impressed with the Moose Lodge in Port Charlotte, Florida. So I took a little bit of a poll of people go to the Moose, and some other people from around different areas were interested in going to their local Moose. So if you go to the Moose or the Elks or any, you know, American Legion, I think if you have a dialogue with the people, then you have a chance at getting a few items, or at least holding, you know, holding the cheese off of a salad, or potentially getting some beans added to the menu. So, you know, call ahead. Look at the menu. See if you can make simple changes. You know, don't try to recreate everything and expect an entirely vegan menu. But if you can have some choices, it's a great compromise to still be able to go out with your friends and get what you want. You know, a lot of times it's an excuse to not eat a plant-based diet. That, you know, they'd rather just not take the time to peruse the people would rather just not take the time to peruse the menu and try to figure something out, or they don't want to be seen as odd guy out, or they feel perhaps that they're being cheated if they don't get the, you know, the taco with all the cheese and the beef. The reality of it is, if you're the lighthouse and you start eating this way for your health, you can start a dialogue, and you're enjoying it, you're looking healthy, you could actually help your friends. So I think it's something to consider, and you certainly have the right to your own food choices. If you don't, you know, you didn't like green beans, nobody would expect you to eat them. So why should they expect you to eat a side of meat if you don't want them? So I think that, you know, people are a little bit more afraid of making these choices than need to be most of the time. Another thing came up about air fryers. You know, that's all the rage. You know, it's has always been the Instant Pot was, you know, the first big piece of equipment that helped people that, you know, are converting to plant-based nutrition save some time. I love my Instant Pot. I make my beans, I make my rice, I make my whole grains in the Instant Pot. I make all my soups in the Instant Pot. And, you know, I love it. It's a great thing. I don't own an air fryer. I'll never own an air fryer. For the simple reason is that, it's another piece of bulky equipment is the big reason. But the other reason is if you're doing an air fryer, you're taking all the moisture out of something to make it crispy. And people say, well, they're looking for the crunch. But when you heat something up to a really high temperature, you're also generating acrylamides, which are unhealthy. So when you burn vegetable, just like burning animal flesh, you generate some chemicals that are, somewhat potentially carcinogenic. But probably even worse is that when you're taking the water out of things and you're making them crunchy and crispy, think potato chip, you're taking away the feedback loops in your brain that, you know, I have eaten something bulky and the stretch receptors in my stomach is going to tell me that I'm full and that I stop eating. So if you air fry all your vegetables, you're not going to be full, which leads people to grab for other things. So then they start to grab for perhaps bread or perhaps other sauces, and things start to become very calorically dense. Then they're not hungry for very long, and then they start grabbing for other desserts and other things, treats. So I think that, you know, in my mind, it leads to overeating. You don't destroy any calories in food when you air fry something. So those calories are still there, but your ability, but for it to take up space is decreased in your stomach. So you're not as full. And I do think that that's a potential to have people overeat if they're trying to watch their calorie intake. And again, you know, making chips out of things, chips are chips. And I don't think that that's a great idea. And then I guess, you know, going from chips to more chips, I got an email from my master swim group. The emails are all hooked together, whether you're a high school or a junior swimmer or a master swimmer at our pool. And I got the email for the upcoming swim meet, and it was asking the parents or people to bring coffee, donuts, muffins, soda, hot chocolate mix, baked chips, and baked goods. I assumed that baked chips were thought to be better than regular chips, so that's the health food we got going on. The reality is baked chips are actually worse than the other chips because, again, of the time left at these high heats, that it generates a lot more acrylamides than even frying. So where frying generates and has a lot of trans fats, the baked will generate these acrylamide chemicals. And again, these are all high-calorie, non-nutritious type foods, muffins with lots of oil, donuts, you know, lots of oil and fat, hot chocolate, lots of sugar, baked goods. You know, I'm assuming most people are going to pick those up. They can be vegan baked goods, and that would be okay if, you know, you made them with limited amount of sugar, but we know that these are going to be baked goods that are, you know, from Costco or the local grocery store. Nobody asks for water. Nobody asks for fruit or any other healthy food. So it was, you know, a vegetable tray, perhaps, you know, little bags of vegetables hooked together with hummus. That would be an alternative to have at a swim meet. Again, little packs of chopped fruit, you know, that would be good. Bananas, oranges, all good. Even potatoes, boiled potatoes, if you're looking for the kids to between meets as far as an energy source. But muffins, not so much. So that's that was a little disappointing. But, you know, unfortunately, we don't think about it so much. Today in class, we talked, we have ongoing last couple lectures in nutrition class about the microbiome. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit more about a study, but there's a huge link with, you know, your microbiome and food cravings and satisfaction after eating and gut health that starts when children are quite young. And, you know, from the moment they're born, depending if they're C-section, vaginal delivery, starts the development of their microbiome. And if the child's not breastfed, then that's not going, you know, then they're at a disadvantage as far as the development further of the microbiome and an increased risk of leaky gut. And then things go on, antibiotics, ear infections, you know, over and over. Kids can get into big trouble. And when you start focusing on all these sweet treats on top of all this, can really lead to, you know, an unhealthy gut, increased allergies, but also some behavioral issues. So we'll come back to that in a little bit. But it, you know, it really, if you have children and they participate in sports, and I know when my daughter was in sports, it was, you know, all about the junk food. And most of the time, kids, you know, they eat breakfast and then an event lasts for a few hours and then you can go eat lunch. They don't really need to have continuous source of calories, and fruit would more than enough take care of it. And if, you know, if teams limited things to fruit and water, like I said, even little boiled potatoes, it would be so much better for the kids overall. In the office, we have monthly wellness challenges, and this month we just finished up our push-up challenge. And so I did, as you know, I'll report in that I got my 500 push-ups in on October 31st, and at swimming today, I kind of felt it with my arms. I felt it a couple ways. You know, I kind of fatigued a little bit at the end, but I also was swimming better. So I really think that the push-ups and the 500, they weren't all from the ground for a standard push-up. I did part of them from my knees, part of them regular push-ups, part of them against the wall and worked my way down. and had them throughout the day. So it wasn't like I did all 500 at once. But over the month, doing one and then one and two and then one, two and three, I have noticed that I've become stronger. I can see it when I lift weights and do rows. I felt it in my swimming today as far as feeling good, feeling stronger. So I would encourage anybody to do a little challenge. The push-ups are good. We put a description on how you can modify things. So if you don't do a straight push-up, how do you do a modified push-up? How do you do a wall push-up? What's a good form? You can YouTube all these things, but you can do your own progression at home, and it's, you know, really, really beneficial. Burn a few extra calories. When I talk to my diabetics, you know, if you can just move a little bit before or after meals, it goes a long way to decreasing the bump in glucose after you eat and also improving the uptake of glucose into the muscle. Even just going up a flight of stairs after eating will improve the postprandial glucose. It'll come back down quicker. So if you have diabetes and you're struggling on getting your glucose down at 3 hours or you're spiking way up above 200, consider a little bit of exercise. Now, if you have cardiovascular disease, it's not a good idea to exercise right after you eat because the blood's being diverted to your stomach, so you're going to get less to your muscles, and so you're actually putting a bit of a strain on your heart. But I'm talking about just, you know, a light exercise, you know, maybe an hour or so after dinner, or again, a little bit before. Taking that 15-minute walk can really help things. And if you're at a desk, taking short breaks, if you have a sit-down job, doing some chair squats, doing a few wall push-ups, taking a break to walk can really, really help glucose control. And it's really important that you develop your leg muscles in order to increase the mitochondria in your legs, increase oxygen uptake, and it's going to help a lot with your glucose control. We had a little incident today with a member that had an allergic reaction on a treadmill, most likely secondary to the cleaning fluids that was used at her local gym. You know, I'm wary of some of the towels, you know, the little dispensers that are given out to clean the different pieces of equipment in gyms. You know, they can be very toxic if you're prone to allergic reaction. So you might want to check with your gym to see what kind of cleaning solutions that they use, and perhaps even carry with you some of your own that you know are less toxic. This was a reaction strong enough to require Benadryl and some steroids. So, you know, a lot of these cleaning supplies, you know, we're trying to kill these, MRSA and all these bad bugs that are in gyms. But in reality, we're selecting for not only worse bacteria, but potentially we're, you know, poisoning people with the chemicals. And in an enclosed building, the bad bugs stay in, the good bugs don't get in, and you have a concentration of the chemical fumes from the cleaning fluids, from the rubber and some of these mats. So, you know, people are going to gyms to try to get healthy, and the reality of it is they might actually be becoming sicker. You know, I think that's one thing good about some of the CrossFit gyms that I've seen on TV, that they're kind of open box, open air fans, that, you know, people can get outside really easy and get things aired out. And of course, I'm a huge advocate of walking, running, biking outside whenever possible, getting your windows open if you do it at home so that you get some of the fresh air in. There was a looking at, you know, institutions, the microbes are much worse on the inside than the outside. We think we're keeping bugs out, but we're actually keeping bad bugs in and the good bugs out. So another member was at a meeting at a hotel, and she sent me the menu, and there was absolutely nothing on the menu that she could eat that was plant-based, that wasn't already gooped up with cheese or oil or butter or was meat. You know, there were chicken dishes, hamburger dishes, Caesar salad with, you know, the Caesar dressing in the cheese. And the bottom said absolutely no substitutions. And even when she tried to, ask the hotel, they's like, no, that's the menu. And so what do you do in that situation? Well, the good news was that when you know ahead that you're going to be involved in something like that, you can ask. When Addie and I went to the West Virginia Dietetics meeting and at the Marriott up in West Virginia, they actually prepared us a vegan menu without oil and salt. So that they knew we were coming in advance and we had our food. The other thing you can do is if your organization is not going to provide you with a plant-based choice, then ask them to reimburse part of the tuition for your meeting if it includes food. If you have to go to lunch as part of one of the talks and you've paid for it, but you can't eat anything, you should at least get that back, in your tuition. And the other thing you can do is they sell these little mini crock pots that people take their lunches in, and you can take one of these little crock pots and plug it in, at an outlet on the side of the room and, have the ability to, have lunch. If you have a hotel room, you could always do it there. And, I'd like to take a moment to talk about a company that I really like, and it's Mama Says, and you can go online and look at some of their foods. But recently I was speaking with one of their founders, and they're actually willing to send food to a hotel if someone's going to be there traveling. So that is an option, is to have, this prepackaged food in a cooler be sent to the kitchen at a hotel that you could have during a meeting. And that is an option that, you could think of. Of course, people do, their own dehydrated meals or just bring a regular lunch, for the day. If it's a day trip, that's always an option. But it's unfortunate if people pay, $50 for a lunch that they can't eat. And it would be so simple, for the hotel to do it. And I think you should make a stink about it. Because if you don't make a stink, or as Seth, Godin would say, make a ruckus, then nobody will ever change. There may be more than one person in the room that would really like a vegan or vegetarian or plant-based option. And, I think if you don't, because oftentimes if you order something, somebody say, well, yeah, I'll do that too. So I think by raising the awareness that, hey, I paid good money for this conference and I deserve to be able to eat if you want me to hear for the conference, then, I need some sort of compensation. So that's what I would try. And if anybody does that, I'd love to hear your story, because the more stories we hear of how people go about things like this, the better opportunity that other people have, to get to plant-based options. So if you know a hotel that you frequent on business trips that, that have the opportunity to get you plant-based food, then, please do so. I know that, we went to Springfield Suites and, they have a nice oatmeal, bar every morning with some fruit. And there's a lot of places that'll give you oatmeal and fruit to have, for the breakfasts. Lunch is often much more difficult. It's always, a lot of times very much processed. Those things come in that just have to be microwaved. I was looking up, some restaurants, and it's amazing that we want to go out to eat, but the majority of the food is pre-prepared. So it's nothing more than frozen dinners that some stranger prepares in the back that we pay eight times the price for. So you have to take that into account when you're feeling disappointed when you're not getting a chain restaurant, rack of ribs or grilled fajitas. Just remember that most of that stuff was frozen and just dumped and put in a fryer and or thrown on the grill with some extra oil. So you're not really missing out at all. And if you can get something cooked fresh, or a salad, a baked potato, you're so far ahead of the game. You're not missing out at all. You're taking a chance on actually becoming healthier. There was another study that was just published looking at the VO2 max, which is the ability of your body to uptake oxygen to a maximum degree, the maximum amount you can take. It's other word for that is cardiorespiratory fitness. And they were able to follow people over years, yet another study, and show that there was a 10 to 30% decrease in cardiovascular events over time, you know, looking at over 4,000 people. This was a study done at Ball State University. People came in, the average age of the people were 43 years of age. They didn't have any cardiovascular disease, and they followed them for an average of 24 years. And mortality across the board, you know, of all causes, decreased 3.3% for every 1 milliliter per kilogram improvement in the baseline peak oxygen uptake. And that corresponds to 11.6% for each improvement in what we call a MET. And we talked about that before on the podcast when we do a stress test on people. We used to do VO2 maxes on everybody when I was in training. You know, you put the headgear on and you breathe out carbon dioxide and you get a finger prick and you actually measure when your body you know, starts to metabolize, become anaerobic, and you measure the carbon dioxide that's expelled, and we can see how much oxygen you're able to uptake. But the other thing that you can do on a standard treadmill is to look at how far somebody goes on specific protocols. So typically we start out slow, and every 3 minutes the speed and the elevation of the treadmill is increased, and every stage, every 3 minute of that corresponds to so many metabolic units, or what we call METs. And so the more METs you can achieve, the correlates with improved fitness. And you know, this study was saying that we probably should bring back the VO2 testing, because you get so much good information on where people are. And if you can just train people to improve their VO2 max a little bit, you can really improve their lifespan. And, you know, this has always been a pet peeve of mine. People have dumbed down the stress test, like we've dumbed down everything, I guess, in life. And so instead of the stress test being taken serious as a piece of where we can get a lot of data on people and really watch their heart rate and watch their blood pressure and you know, whether they're having symptoms, watch their EKG to see whether they're having any arrhythmias, measure the VO2 max. We've dumbed it down with the advent of nuclear tracers. So you know, the studies came out. So if you can get somebody to about 85% of their estimated peak heart rate, you know, which is 220 minus your age, then the nuclear tracer is accurate enough so you don't have to push people anymore. So that translates into you can do more stress tests in a shorter period of time. And also translates, well, if you're not getting people's heart rate up any more than 85%, it's probably more safe. So then you can have somebody that's less trained do the stress tests. So now the physician has exited the room in a lot of places, never in my office, by the way. And so technicians or allied health professionals do these tests. Well, it seems like a simple thing to do a stress test on someone, but you're actually taking someone that you need to know their history and what their potential risk for heart disease is before you put them on the treadmill. If they're having chest pain at rest, those aren't people you should put on the treadmill. If somebody has significant valvular disease, which you would pick up with a stethoscope and a trained ear, you wouldn't want to put those people on a treadmill. If they already have a fast heart rate because they're having an arrhythmia, you wouldn't want to put those people on a treadmill. And there are some people that just don't exercise. They're sedentary and they're not even used to walking on a treadmill. So they're very uncomfortable. They may not be dressed appropriately. They may not have the right shoes on. For whatever reason, they start to walk. They become panicked. I've had people over the years that, you know, they're not used to even breaking a sweat. So when they first start to break a sweat or they first start to huff and puff, they're panicked. And in the case of somebody that's not trained to watch and deal with this, then they just turn it off. Or again, they're just trying to get to this 85% and they turn it off, but you're missing all this great information about their peak METs that they can attain, what their blood pressure did, how quickly their heart rate came down, what their oxygen saturation was, you know, what is their heart rate in corresponding to how long they were on the treadmill. So you miss a tremendous amount of information by doing this. And so we, you know, these stress tests are just, you know, done one after another, and people say, well, you know, they come back equivocal, and, you know, you send the person gets sent to the cardiologist because they have an abnormal stress test. And, you know, maybe even a radiologist may have read it instead of the cardiologist that was actually should have been right there doing it. So the radiologist has never seen the patient. They don't know anything about their history. They don't want to miss something, so they overread it. So now you have an abnormal nuclear reading and you have a suboptimal treadmill test. And the next thing you know, the person's referred for a heart catheterization. And then they may not even have had any symptoms, and you find some blockage, and you know, somebody ends up with a stent. And this, you know, this people down this rabbit hole. And you know, I mean, all for not having an adequate test. So take home message: if someone refers you for a stress test, you deserve to have the physician in the room, and you need to exercise to your maximum capability. So yes, you should huff and puff. Most people don't have to run unless they are in shape, and then they'll be able to tolerate to the point where they're actually running. But if somebody's sedentary, their heart rate goes up to, you know, 90 or 100% without ever walking. But you need to have that. So if you're going to take time and spend your money or spend your insurance company's money on, and you want to know the answer, then you need to have an adequate test. And it really will save you in the long run by having a good test as opposed to a test that is gray that leads to unnecessary testing. But, you know, going back to the data, you know, not only did cardiovascular mortality improve when your exercise capacity improves, but your cancer mortality and your overall all-cause mortality decreased when you were more fit, when you could take up more oxygen. So, you know, this is, you know, another reason to exercise, and to exercise vigorously. You know, every time that you go out doesn't have to be all out, you know, hands on your knees exhaustion, but you do have to get your heart rate up when you exercise. At least, you know, 20% of the time you should be getting a pretty high heart rate. And that should be directed by your physician if you're older and you haven't exercised before. So you can demand an exercise prescription. We work with people all the time to, you know, give them zones, to give them an exercise prescription for how that they should improve, because a lot of people, you know, they don't get anywhere because they go out and they try to go too fast, or they try to do too much too quick. And, you know, it needs to be taken and individualized. You know, one plan doesn't fit all. So, you know, in our office, we're very, we love to work with people to try to improve their VO2 max. The Garmin watches are pretty good at giving some estimate, but you can actually get this done in certain physicians' office where you can do a VO2 max test or at university settings if you really want a number. But, you know, with metabolic units and a good stress test, you can get that information as well. I was getting my hair cut, and I overheard a conversation between a couple other stylists and another patron about, you know, hearing about BMI. And they were talking that if your blood pressure was okay and your BMI was okay, and you didn't smoke, that, you know, you're pretty much healthy and good to go. And they started to argue about, you know, BMI, body mass index. And, you know, the first thing that comes up is that, well, that can be that can be inaccurate, because, you know, if you have a lot of muscle, then your BMI might be higher, and so it's not really reflective. And where that can be true on on our outliers, you know, the majority of people in the middle, that's, you know, that's not true. We want 18.5 to 24.9 is the normal range. There was a study done at the Lancet that looked on people at both extremes, you know, being at increased risk. So if you're really skinny, you could get into trouble, just like if your BMI is really high, you know, and again, then people misinterpret that and say, well, you got to be careful. So-and-so is too skinny. They're on a plant-based diet. We certainly don't want people, below a normal BMI. We like people to be in the middle range. We like people to be in the middle range of a BMI with good muscle mass. Unfortunately, there's also studies looking at women, especially after menopause, that even with a normal BMI, they carry a lot of more visceral fat or abdominal fat. And so one way you can kind of put two and two together is if you measure waist size as well as BMI, you can get an idea of visceral fat, which is usually predominantly white fat, which has a lower, more inflammatory metabolic process. So if women's hips are or waist are greater than 31.5 inches versus men 37, then they're probably carrying too much abdominal fat, and despite their BMI, that needs to be redistributed. And in a lot of diabetics, that's an issue, because one of the risks for diabetes is carrying visceral fat or abdominal fat that's around your organs, around your liver, around your pancreas, inside the muscles, inside the liver, fatty liver. And typically it's on the outside as well. So when you see fat on the outside in the belly, then there's typically excess of fat on the inside in the belly. And that's very hormonal. It's not just, making people, it's not just the way you're put together, you're an apple or an orange, but it actually carries risk with it. And a lot of times when we're trying to get people off of their diabetic medications, it comes down to trying to change their body composition as well. So we actually want to build muscle, and specifically leg muscle, and then we get a redistribution of their fat and increase leg muscle and decrease abdominal fat, and that allows their body to metabolize glucose better, takes the work off the pancreas, and helps people improve quicker. So, yet another reason why we want our diabetics and everybody to be exercising and to do your leg exercises specifically, or do your squats and, do things that build up your leg muscles. But it is really important that, we do take in consideration normalizing people's body mass index. Now, a heavy weightlifter that carries a lot of muscle mass may have a, less fat mass. And if there's a discrepancy, there's different scans that can be done to look at fat mass to see if that person's actually healthy. But a lot of times, you can look at the defensive line people. I think most people would agree that the defensive line on football teams, those people are overweight. They're big, they're very tall and they've got lots of muscles, but they also have lots of fat and they're not healthy. And it pans out when they retire, and a lot of them have issues with injury and inflammation at a very early age, and high blood pressure, and a lot of problems. So you really have to, it's kind of a hard thing to talk about sometimes when you're talking about fat mass and, I'm muscle, I'm not muscle, but for health reasons, and it's all health reasons, we need to take those things into consideration. So I think I'll finish up today with fun things, some of the favorite meals I made this week. I'll start out with, again, it's persimmon season. I was able to get some local persimmons. I love those for breakfast. I make a big fruit bowl. I make a granola, and my granola is oats with a few walnuts, and I use apples in the food processor to make the juice, or I use blueberries. I add some cacao powder and some raisins and dried cherries, and then I dry that in my dehydrator and sprinkle some of that on my fruit in the morning. That's my favorite breakfast, and I just vary the fruit according to what's in season. Currently now we've got good grapes, persimmons, pineapples are good down here. Papaya is always one of my favorites. So those are my favorite breakfasts. I did make the enchiladas. I think I talked about it last week that I was going to. I made my own corn tortillas, and in one we had beans and rice and roasted red peppers, and the other one it had spinach, artichokes, hearts, and mushrooms. And then I did an adobo sauce with dried peppers that I got at my local store. So that turned out really good. So it was one of my favorite meals this week. And I also did a butternut squash sauce. And I did a little smoky this time with some smoked paprika and some chili powder and some garlic. And I did that over cauliflower and kale. So those are, I guess, three of my favorite meals that I had this week. In class today, we did a chili over polenta. So I showed the class how to make a polenta, and you can flavor that however you want. We did cilantro and hot peppers in our polenta today. So, you know, those are some of the good things. And if you have that polenta and you make, you know, a couple cups makes an 8x8 dish, you can slice that off and have it, you know, for lunch with a salad or with some beans. So it makes for a quick meal and leftovers. And we have soup once a week so that we can have, you know, leftover soup for lunch or, you know, a couple nights with soup. So every night you don't have to cook. So it makes it pretty simple. You know, I told somebody today, and it's true, I enjoy every meal that I eat and I look forward to the next one. So I hope you do too. I hope you get some good ideas. You can check out our website for some recipes and even sign up for our newsletter. You'll get recipes every month as well as other wellness tips. If you go to drdelaney.com, drdelaney.com, email me at jamie@drdelaney with any questions. I'd love to hear about your travel experiences as far as your business travel and what you've done to circumvent any problems with hotels or what you're doing with at meetings. I think that'd be a great topic for discussion. And, you know, look at our practice. We talk to people all over. You don't have to be in Port Charlotte, but if you are, we'd love to have you come to, you know, our office, our nutrition classes. But if you're not in the area, we do online consultations. And, you know, I have Addie Delaney Minor, which is my registered dietitian. And, you know, we do great plans for people, and you see our faces and you talk to us, and, you know, we're, in good contact with people. You're not passed off to somebody. It's not, just one size fits all. We're the real deal, and we want to, meet you and speak with you and work with you and help you to become, healthier. So if you have any interest, give us a call, give us an email. We can set up a virtual tour or an in-person tour. We'd love to see you. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.